Worldwide, 50 million people are living with dementia. By 2050, that figure is projected to reach 150 million people. This rapid growth in the prevalence of dementia puts pressure on public health resources, creating a significant global socio-economic impact. Alzheimer's disease is distinctive for its effect on a patient's family and loved ones. The gradual disappearance of the person they know is extremely painful, whilst the care they require is a constant challenge, which seriously affects the caregiver's mental and physical health. Therapeutic interventions targeting the early stages of cognitive impairment and lowering the rate of disease progression would offer substantial clinical and economic benefits for patients, their caregivers, and society. At present, there is a significant unmet need for such treatments. We hope to change that. We are building a community of investigators and study coordinators at more than 400 sites in 40 different countries from all over the world. Along with over 3,500 patients and their caregivers, this community will collaborate globally, embarking on the same important journey. The EVOKE trials. We're doing this to contribute to Alzheimer's disease research. We're doing this for our patients and their families. It's a groundbreaking journey for us, and we're excited to be on it with you.
Welcome to today's panel discussion with the title GLP-1 Receptor Agonists, Alzheimer's Disease and Other Cognitive Disorders. My name is Oliver Peters. I'm a professor of the Department of Psychiatry and Psychotherapy at the Charité in Berlin, where I lead the module on geriatric medicine. And I would like to start by introducing the participants in today's discussion. Professor Jens Jüll Holst is a member of the Novo Nordisk Foundation Center for Basic Metabolic Research and discovered the hormone GLP-1 in 1986 in connection with his work on gastric ulcer surgery. Professor Lotte Bjerg-Knudsen is inventor of GLP-1 receptor agonist liraglutid and chief scientific advisor in research and early development at Novo Nordisk. She has been active in GLP-1 field for more than 20 years as a project leader for research projects and in the preclinical area of the liraglutid development project. Professor Tina Wilsboll is the clinic director at the Steno Diabetes Center and focuses on the pathophysiology of obesity, prediabetes, and type 2 diabetes, with particular emphasis on insulin, glucagon, and incretin hormones. And finally, I would like to introduce my co-moderator, Dr. Salvatore Carana, which is a senior director at Novo Nordisk in the fields of cerebrovascular disease and kidney disease, NASH and Alzheimer's disease. Both diabetes and dementia are highly prevalent age-related diseases, and observations have long suggested that Alzheimer's disease are probably regulatory disturbances in the utilization of glucose in the brain. If Alzheimer's disease and diabetes share similar mechanisms of development, it is reasonable to assume that anti-diabetic drugs could also be effective in people with Alzheimer's disease. In the following discussion, we would like to shed light on the high unmet need for the treatment of AD. And I would go into the first round of our questions, which we would like to discuss, and the key aspects of the introducing the topics. This is a question for all of us, for all the participants of the discussion today. How do you see a potential treatment of Alzheimer's disease with GLP-1 receptor agonists? who wants to start with this key question of our discussion today?
I can start. I think that we're seeing more and more understanding of Alzheimer's disease as a chronic disease with multiple components in the pathophysiology. We used to know more about the amyloid and tau and also cholesterol, but I think now, especially with genetics, we're seeing a broadening on the understanding of what is involved in Alzheimer's disease. And there, inflammation also comes up. So I think there are many things that these GLP-1 agents can potentially do. Of course, we don't know yet, we haven't proven yet that there is an effect in Alzheimer's disease, but there are certainly many hypotheses that can be relevant in patients with Alzheimer's disease. Our leading hypothesis for semaglutide is that there is an effect on neuroinflammation that is an established interventional pathway in Alzheimer's disease that has been tested out before, and now it's kind of with a new angle. So that is hopefully something that can make a difference.
Yeah, I would say from a clinical point of view, we know a lot about GLP-1. I mean, Jens have worked with GLP-1 for more than 40 years, and we have a lot of knowledge about GLP-1, how it is in the central nervous system. It works as a neurotransmitter. Lotte have beautifully demonstrated in animal models. We also have indications in humans that GLP-1, when injected peripherally as a GLP-1 receptor agonist, it actually reaches the central nervous system. It was probably meant to be, or the longer story with GLP-1 is the glucose lowering effect through insulin. But since then, that's the definition actually of an incretin hormone. But since then, we've learned so much more. GLP-1, this great little peptide, is so much more than a glucose-lowering drug. It has several, especially when we treat our patients with the analogs, added benefits, anti-inflammation, decrease in body weight, effect on also recently, or not recently anymore, the last 5 years, we've learned that it has effect on the cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes. So it's so much more than a glucose-lowering drug. I've used it for a long time. I learned a lot about diabetes. I don't know too much about Alzheimer's, but what I know, merging those two things make a lot of sense seen from the, you know, clinical perspective.
Mm. Yeah, and then also importantly, to just briefly add that we're not testing semaglutide in patients with diabetes. We're testing semaglutide in patients with Alzheimer's disease. Yeah. There will be some that have diabetes, but it's not a trial in diabetic patients with Alzheimer's.
So all the difficult questions are left to me, I understand. So the research in neurodegenerative diseases and GLP-1 really started back, 20 years ago, actually. Perry was the name who did the first studies. And people were very optimistic about this. This was intracerebral administration, mainly of a GLP-1 agonist. And one of the inspirations for that, of course, is the very widespread expression of the GLP-1 receptor in the brain. Now, that has also been pretty confusing because, you can ask, how do you get to those sites? How do you get to those receptor sites in the brain? And then it turns out that these receptors, the majority of them, are probably targets for some neurons in the brainstem, in the nucleus of the solitary tract, that project to various regions of the brain and produce GLP-1, and there comes the neurotransmitter story. And so the big thing has been to understand whether there is an interaction between the peripheral GLP-1 producing cells, the peripheral system, and the brain system. And this, our knowledge about this is still completely, very, very small. At least it's vague. Once we're talking about this, the big question comes up: how does peripherally administered GLP-1 reach the brain? And can it access all these receptors? And it cannot. But we know now very well, not the least because of beautiful studies at the Novo Nordisk, where they've injected fluorescent molecules. We know where it goes, where the peripheral GLP-1 agonists go. And we know the sites of entry, the circumventricular organs mainly. And we also know neurons that are excited, because in these circumventricular organs, there is also an expression of GLP-1 receptors. So you can act on cells there, and you can then, using CFOS, also look at secondary activation of other neurons. So there's a fairly good idea of what is possible from the periphery and the brain. Now we need to coordinate those two knowledge sets of knowledge to try to understand how this is possible. We used to say, you know, jokingly, that neurons love a little bit of cyclic AMP. So if you could do something with adenylate cyclase in the brain, it's a good thing. And the GLP-1 receptor, of course, is an adenylate cyclase activating thing. So it doesn't surprise us that if you have neurons in culture, that they thrive when you give them a little bit of GLP-1. That's not the question, really. The question is, how does it get there? And can we reach the sites where it really matters?
Yeah, and I would like to also include other things than neurons in the discussion, because there's astrocytes, there is microglia, there's oligodendrocytes, and there's oxidative stress, and there's the blood-brain barrier, which is damaged in neurodegenerative diseases, and through various different mechanisms, GLP-1 actually can have an impact on these systems. So I think it's for those of you that don't know GLP-1 so much, it's always like the story is that this is a multifaceted hormone and neurotransmitter, neuromodulator. So it's doing a lot of different things at the same time. So it's difficult for some people to understand, because it's easier, you know, say, okay, you have an effect on insulin, you lower blood glucose, or you have an effect on amyloid, you clear that. But I think with these chronic age-related diseases, there are often so many parts of the pathophysiology, that so many different things involved in the pathophysiology. So it's actually good to have a drug that has multiple ways that it can intervene on. I think that's the story with GLP-1. I think it's a little more difficult to comprehend, but I do think that's the more true story.
It is at least very much the story in type 2 diabetes and obesity, and probably also in a chronic disease as Alzheimer's. Yeah.
Can I just ask something? Because you have discussed, Jens, about this blood-brain barrier, and there are like a few studies. I think actually it was a study from your group. Showing that the liraglutide, I mean, only small quantity could, you know, really pass. But the GLP-1 receptor agonists, they're not all the same. Do you expect that, you know, different GLP-1 receptor agonists, you know, behave in different ways, and maybe they do pass the...
So there is some studies, and you have generated some studies indicating that there may be differences in the access of these various GLP-1 receptor agonists. So first of all, there are some big molecules. There's dulaglutide, and there was albiglutide, right? That were big molecules, and if the concept I've described about the access via the fenestrae in the leaky blood vessels in the circumventricular organs is correct, then you would think that the large molecule substances would have a difficulty in accessing these parts of the brain. And I think this is true, actually. The evidence is not super strong, but it's very likely. So you would think that a big molecule would have a difficulty, and that is probably reflected in the fact that albiglutide had very little effect on body weight at all, and that dulaglutide also is inferior compared to the smaller molecules in this respect. So that's one thing. I'm always, you know, whenever people say that something crosses the blood-brain barrier, I start to get, you know, a little bit excited, because that is a difficult question. It's a difficult discipline to do. And when they particularly suggest that a peptide should be able to penetrate the blood-brain barrier, I said, no.
But what you mean with that, right, is on the endothelial cells. And we have clearly shown that that does not happen.
Exactly.
We have shown that in vitro. It's in our semaglutide mode of action paper that was in JCI.
Yes. But there is some literature out there saying that exenatide, for instance, penetrates or passes the blood-brain barrier. Yeah. And I must say that I think that's inaccurate. I mean, it does not.
And in those studies, you know, what they do is that they take a whole brain and they homogenate the brain. And then they measure an amount. But that is such a difficult technique to get right, because there's just a tiny bit of contamination from the blood. And then your experiment is not valid. You need to do either whole brain staining, or you need to look at a clean cell system.
So,
and back to the study we did was we tried to measure liraglutide in cerebrospinal fluid. So it's not exactly the same. So we did a lumbar puncture, and look whether there was actually liraglutide.
And we had all the troubles of measuring it.
Yeah,
but
low number
I would say
of
no,
patients.
There was nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, there was 30,000 picomoles per liter of liraglutide in the peripheral circulation, and 3 at the most in the cerebrospinal fluid. I mean, that
could be. It can be relevant, right? But then it still doesn't explain why would it have an effect in the entire hippocampus. Yeah. I think it's probably more relevant that there can be effects that come from the vasculature. And of course, the blood-brain barrier is huge. And it looks like there's actually a GLP-1 receptor in the on the smooth muscle cells in the vasculature. So that's a way to affect the brain,
see,
right?
That's interesting. That's exactly. Yeah. No, that's what I would have said also.
Professor Peters, one question from you. So we can go back to the Alzheimer bit. Can you talk about, you know, what are the main abnormalities in Alzheimer disease? So then we can see how GLP-1 receptor agonists can tackle those.
Yes. This is really a difficult question to cover completely. To summarize it, we know since many years that amyloid has something to do with the disease, and then we have tau pathology. These are the main both pathologies that are discussed over many years, and what has happened in clinical research is that developed antibodies against amyloid and antibodies against tau. And to sum it up, what we know today is that interfering with the amyloid metabolism and removing amyloid from the brain can slow down a little bit, at least, the progression of the disease. And it appears that this is more true if you do this very early on in the disease. But at the same time, regarding the tau pathology, we were not successful at all until today. So it was not possible to interfere with this kind of pathology. So today, inflammation and other mechanisms of the disease come more and more into the center of what we are interested in, and therefore I believe that this approach with the GLP-1 agonist is a very interesting one, because it, as you said, it covers many aspects of the pathology, which is obviously of relevance within the disease. And therefore, it's very helpful that we are now doing this clinical trial and investigate how relevant this is for a progression of the disease.
You could actually also imagine that those improvements in the blood-brain barrier and inflammation and all the things could actually improve on the lymphatic system, so you can actually get a better clearance also of amyloid and tau. You know, that's I have no data to suggest that GLP-1 has an effect on the lymphatic system, but theoretically, if you improve on the many components of neuroinflammation, you should also have better flow to and from the brain, which could help with clearance.
Mm. Very interesting. So tau, amyloid, inflammation. So what do you think is the main?
We forgot to talk about the blood vessels. Because here we have something that is really also extremely interesting. I mean, the major question is, for instance, atherosclerosis. Is GLP-1 really seriously interfering with the progression of atherosclerosis? And there are quite a number of indications that this may actually be the case. Number one, so one of the places where we think there is an expression normally of the GLP-1 receptor is actually in the endothelial cells and also in some other blood vessel cells. So, I mean, we have a possibility to have an action there. And there are several experimental models of atherosclerosis that where GLP-1 has a clear effect. I mean, in mouse models, unfortunately. And now there is a big cardiovascular outcome study on its way, where this is being looked at directly. And we're talking about things like plaque stability and progression and really detailed tracer studies and things like that to find out whether this is really, really true. But if it is, then of course, to interfere with progression of atherosclerosis, particularly in the brain, is of huge interest. So this is, in my mind, this is one of the major ways that GLP-1s could influence this.
And we know we have a good effect on stroke, right? So we know that.
I think what has happened in the stroke business is one of the most exciting news from the GLP-1 receptor agonist field. So there's a very, very significant effect on stroke. This is unique, you know. There's hardly a single other drug that influences the risk of stroke. And this is quite significant.
And those data are from patients with diabetes, with either established cardiovascular disease or at high risk of cardiovascular disease. They're treated in the so-called sustained 6 trial, where they receive diabetic doses of semaglutide, 1 milligram, for 2 years. And the primary endpoint was MACE, cardiovascular death, non-fatal myocardial infarction, and non-fatal stroke. And it was actually superior compared to placebo, especially on stroke. Very, very beautiful results. And when you look at the figures from those trials, they seem to deviate more and more, which is really why we believe, usually we do that in church, but we believe that it might actually be able to change the life story of atherosclerosis. That's really, really interesting. And then there is a huge trial, the SELECT trial, going on in obesity, more patients, longer time, 17,000 plus patients for a longer period, and there much more data will be shown. Those patients do not, some of them, well, they do not have diabetes at the inclusion, so that's really, really interesting.
And I guess we should also remind everyone that even though we're talking about an anti-diabetic agent, this is not an agent that causes hypoglycemia. Yeah. That's kind of built into the mechanism that it's a glucose-dependent mechanism. This is why it's also safe to treat patients with obesity. And I think that's very important to just mention that one should not be worried about.
And the effect on stroke shows up in all of the GLP-1 receptor agonist studies. Yeah. So it's not just something that is unique for one of them, you know, which would give us a problem, right? But it's for all of them. So I think it's really exciting. So this is one of the most exciting news for the last few years.
Okay, so to sum up, we have heard that there's lots of evidence coming from basic research that this kind of mechanism is of interest to interfere with Alzheimer's disease. I would like to move on to the clinical part, and I would like to ask my co-moderator, Salvatore, could you elaborate on the rationale for the EVOKE trials and the development of semaglutide in Alzheimer's disease?
Yeah, so I think we already have said, I mean, the basis. I mean, Lode also has carried out a lot of like very interesting and compelling results in the preclinical setting. In addition to that, I think in some of the trials that Tina also was mentioning is about, you know, the same molecule but in different formulations, semaglutide. We've seen actually in these trials that when you put together all the data we have in this diabetes population, you actually can see a reduction of like almost 50% in the diagnosis of dementia in this different kind of population that are not patients with Alzheimer. So in addition to that, we have a number of both real-world evidence data, very promising, and small RCT with different GLP-1 receptor agonists. Jens was talking about dulaglutide, is one other very important GLP-1 receptor agonist. They show very nice data on reduction in decline of cognitive impairment and many other small things. So I think taking together the preclinical data, the real-world evidence data, the RCT, they are giving us a very promising and compelling story. And that's why we have actually, you know, gone through already to phase 3 with the EVOKE trials and not gone through all the phases in development, because we know very well the drug is a very well-established safety profile. And we decided to just go to these like two large main trials, the EVOKE and EVOKE Plus. There are more than 3,600 patients included there. But I want to also ask Lode, because she also has been the mastermind behind, so please.
I think you mentioned all of the everything, all the different kinds of evidence. Perhaps we could just mention that for dulaglutide, they actually predefined a cognitive questionnaire based on the MoCA, I think it was. So that actually is a strong piece of evidence in 10,000 patients. Obviously, that was with diabetes, but then we have all these other bits of pieces of evidence that all kind of point in the same direction. But we do not have a classical phase 2 dose-finding study in Alzheimer's, because when we looked at that, we realized it probably would have to be as big as a phase 3 trial. So we might as well say, you know, we have two phase 3 trials. One of them actually allow for vascular disease also, but they are both kind of classical amyloid-based Alzheimer's disease trials.
I think one lesson that we learned from Alzheimer clinical trials is over the years that there is a certain point within the disease, a point of no return, where you cannot expect anymore that you will really be able to modify the progression of the disease. One very important question that I have, additional question, is what do you think until when this kind of mechanism can really make a change? Or in other words, what kind of patients might show the most benefit from this kind of treatment? Early on, later on?
Yeah, that's a really, really difficult question.
I can try to make an analogy to the heart, if I may, because I still believe that the vascular thing is an important one. So in the heart, if you have an established heart failure condition, the GLP-1s do not help. That was thought for a while. We thought that it would have fantastic effects on pumping action of the heart and all that. That turns out not to be true. So once you have heart failure, you cannot do anything with a GLP-1 receptor agonist. But what you can do is you can prevent them from happening. So we know that now from the meta-analysis, there is a significant reduction in the risk of developing heart failure while you're on therapy. So it's probably the same, you know. It's about getting there early and prevent the damage. Because once the damage has happened, then it's difficult. And also, if you look at the mechanism via GLP-1 receptor and cyclic AMP and all that, how on earth should it remove a big calcification or a big damage to? So it doesn't do that. It's not a growth factor. Not there, at least. But to prevent it from happening, that's something. That's where I would put my money.
So the obvious answer is, of course, to say early always makes more sense, because it's unlikely that you can revert neurodegeneration, right? Early, but isn't that
it's really generally true?
But it's difficult, because how early should you then go? Because the progression of Alzheimer's disease is complicated. But there is actually one, what you call the investigator-initiated trial in pretty late Alzheimer's disease with liraglutide that showed some interesting results. It was probably not powered enough, but what we discussed when that was published, it didn't see significant effects really on the primary endpoint, was that it was probably too late. So I fully agree, early as possible, but how early then is probably more up to people like you who work with Alzheimer's disease to decide. But to change the life story, it would probably be as early as possible.
Can I do something that, you know, I think people have not been doing for many, many years? Contradict Jens Ulholst.
Oh.
I will try. So I don't want to contradict fully, but I would just underline that, you know, we're actually doing like a trial with semaglutide and heart failure, and especially the preserved ejection fraction. So it's ongoing. It's called STEP-FPEP.
I know.
It's very interesting.
And you know, it's fine that you're optimistic still, but you know, the enthusiasm around 2005 regarding the pumping action on the heart. Yeah. And there were several studies, even clinical studies, showing,
Will liraglutide?
No, GLP-1 infusions. And,
okay.
Not necessarily the agonist.
We'll and it is also, I guess, in the heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, is like, I think at around that time, we were just more saying, oh, heart failure, we put them all in the same box.
Exactly.
And now we more have these two different pathophysiologies. I don't know if that's correct. I think there's also some people who are skeptic around whether HFpEF is a disease or just a syndrome, right? But
But you're right, I agree.
So let's just wait a little bit.
Well done.
You're still hopeful. Good.
You're brave now.
Okay. Moving from type 2 diabetes trials to Alzheimer's research with semaglutide, what are your thoughts on the EVOKE trials from the endocrinologist perspective?
Well, I think it's really interesting. We know that patients with diabetes have more Alzheimer's disease, but I'm really looking forward to have this. I mean, see the results from the EVOKE trial. It's with oral semaglutide, which is really, really interesting that you can actually give a peptide orally. From Novo Nordisk's side, it was said that it's easier for the patients with Alzheimer's to take a tablet than an injection. That's probably right. It's really interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing the data. We know from the clinic that patients can actually, cheat about their memory. And in diabetes, it's a huge problem because they can compensate, not cheat, but compensate for their memory loss at an early point. So I'm very much looking forward to seeing it. And again, as Lida said, it doesn't induce hypoglycemia. It has overall positive effects with many things, weight, blood pressure, cholesterol, and so on. So, I mean, worst case scenario for Novo, you could say, is that it doesn't change the life story of Alzheimer's disease, but I'm very, very confident that it will not have or harm patients with Alzheimer's disease. So I really believe that it will be a beneficial effect.
And you have to titrate, right?
You have to titrate.
To manage the gastrointestinal side effects.
But can I ask you maybe, you know, just a topic that Tina brought up here about the oral tablet as compared to many other drugs investigated in Alzheimer's. Do you think it's a true advantage for people living with Alzheimer's, or how do you see it?
Yes. I mean, this is what we already learned from the earliest trials testing acetylcholine esterase inhibitors, that the tablets per se are preferred, I would say, by Alzheimer's disease patients. This is what we learned, and it's also very easy for the caregivers to handle that. Yeah, I would say this is suitable. Yeah. So moving on within our discussion, etiology, is there an overlap between Alzheimer's disease, type 2 diabetes, and obesity? And what is the overlap? So who wants to explain this?
Well, we covered it a little bit already. I mean, type 2 diabetes and obesity, inflammation, cardiovascular disease, for example, high-sensitive CRP brings them together, the atherosclerosis. So yes, I think indeed that there is a large overlap in those three diseases. Chronic diseases, patients live longer and longer. So our patients with type 2 diabetes and obesity, they live longer, and then there is this overlap in dementia also. So
lipids, we know that ApoE4 is the most common genetic variant to give an increased risk of Alzheimer's disease. So there's also I guess it's not very well understood exactly what does that mean. Is it because the plasma membrane of the neurons are dysfunctional, but there's definitely a lipid angle that's also in the spectrum of diabetes and obesity.
Okay. Will the neglect of the complication in diabetes change with possible future approval of repurposing of semaglutide to halt the progression of Alzheimer's disease?
Right, so one of the most encouraging things, I think, is these new reports on cognitive function in people. That, I think, is very important. And it seems overall that there is an improvement. It's been nicely shown in the REWIND studies where this was looked at specifically. And I mean, given that this is But the Alzheimer's problem is also contained in this thing, the cognitive impairment. Then I think it's you know, it's really encouraging. It makes you think that this might really work. We still have to know the molecular details here, but it's encouraging.
Mm-hmm. But obviously, we need the data, right?
Yeah.
We need the trials to finish, and we need 3,600 patients in there.
For a long period, that's the problem, you could say. I mean, with diabetes, it's much easier. You can take half a year, see the effect on glucose, insulin. Mm. Here, due to the slow progression of dementia and Alzheimer's disease, indeed, you need a longer time. So, and I've actually, since this has been out in the public, I would say, every second week or once a month, I get an email from, because I have been within the field of GLP-1 for a long time, I get an email. There is an unmet need out there from patients who have family members that are suffering from dementia. And say, well, can I start? Should I start? So there is really an unmet need out there. So, I mean, Novo Nordisk should really speed up this process. It's difficult, though.
Returning to the thing we just discussed, I mean, the fact that a major company is doing this now, I mean, that wouldn't have been done 10 years ago. Nobody would have said, this is not possible. This is too expensive. We can't do this. But now it's done, and it's fantastic. It's really wonderful. So I'm personally extremely grateful for this trial because this is really interesting.
Yeah.
I think we feel that we're being welcomed to the field, right? So we've had a bit of learning in how to communicate what GLP-1 might be doing and getting our vocabulary right. But I think we feel welcomed to the field, and many investigators actually think that it is interesting that someone is coming with something new. No, I think at Novo Nordisk we have really a strong confidence in our ability to do large outcome-like trials, and I think we have that coming maybe with a fresh eye into this field. So we're hopeful, but we do need more, many more patients.
And I think it's important with all the knowledge we have about GLP-1 that I really believe you won't harm the patients. So it's also, and if you have beneficial results, then it's a winner, isn't it?
Yeah.
So yes, it's risky to set up such a large trial with many patients, but I mean, it's not risky for the patient, and that's only risky for Novo Nordisk, and that's of course also why family members contact us as healthcare providers to get this tool, which is reminiscent
of the situation when FDA demanded these cardiovascular outcome trials on all new diabetes agents in 2009, I believe it was. So now we are in a new situation. What about Alzheimer's? And so now this is going to be our new outcome trial for Alzheimer's disease. So everybody said in 2009, this is awful. This is terrible that they're doing this. This is a waste of time and money. It was not. It turned out to change the entire picture and understanding of cardiovascular disease and how it could be treated. And I hope that the same will happen with the Alzheimer trial.
You mentioned already that this is really a huge challenge in Alzheimer's disease. If you want to show disease modification, you have to wait for a long time. What would you expect regarding semaglutid? Until when does the group that is treated and the placebo group starts to diverge?
No, that's for you.
That is a difficult question.
We
don't know, but we can look at what happened with the cardiovascular data, because there we actually saw a separation that was really, really early. Again, coming back to what you mentioned, let's not forget about atherosclerosis and the vasculature, but because the outcome data where we see an effect both on stroke, AMI, and cardiovascular death, that kind of speaks to that an underlying effect on atherosclerosis could be behind this. And we do see a clear early separation. So obviously, we hope that again with this mechanism where we have many things that have been involved is that we could actually start to see an early separation. But I have to be honest and say we have absolutely no clue, right?
But you probably need a while, because from the Pioneer 6 trial with oral semaglutide only being 15 months, you were not quite there, whereas with the Sustain 6, it's different trials and different populations, but in the Sustain 6, with injectable sema, which was 2 years, predefined to be 2 years, more hard endpoints turned up. So you probably need some years, but I mean, what do I know about Alzheimer's? Not much, but I think you would need a couple of years to have at least a significant effect.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe it's more a question to you.
Exactly. Yeah. Let's push it back when we can answer. Yeah.
Because I mean, the trial is long enough to show a separation, but you know, your mind, what would be the ideal length of a trial in AD?
Yeah, it depends on the starting point. I mean, it depends on where the individual patient stands within the Alzheimer's continuum. What we know today is that for prevention trials, we really need up to 4 years of treatment until the both groups might have a chance to divide. This is different regarding more pronounced stages of the disease, but then you have the difficulty that probably the dynamic of the disease is also already that strong that you cannot interfere with the disease anymore. And this is the field where we are moving back and forward. So either we are too late, then we cannot slow down the progression anymore, or we are too early, and then we have to wait for a long, long time until the mechanism takes action.
And the VOC trials actually will focus on this early AD, so yeah. MCI or early dementia. So maybe that is exactly the window.
MCI means stage 3 of Alzheimer's disease, mild dementia would be stage 4. If you do a secondary prevention trial, or which is closely located to primary prevention, you would move on to stage 2. But this is clearly where most of the clinical trials today are situated, in this early phase of symptomatic Alzheimer's disease, where patients already recognize that they have memory problems, that they have orientation problems, and so on. So this is the classical view. Yeah. Okay, I think we have covered a lot of these mechanistic questions. Probably just one of those who probably have not been totally covered. Are there benefits which are potentially mediated by the effects on insulin?
Yeah, I get why that question is coming, right? Because this is an insulin secretagogue. Actually, in reality, there's actually quite small effect on insulin, right? Because, and then the more the weight loss also means that there's a better insulin sensitivity in the tissue. So actually, what GLP-1 does to increase insulin secretion in patients is quite small. This is unlikely for me to have a direct effect via insulin. And then also in Alzheimer's disease, I learned there's quite a lot of focus also on insulin sensitivity in the brain. And yes, maybe GLP-1 can work on some of those same pathways, but it's not as such an effect via insulin, in my opinion.
And yeah. I would support that. Yeah. The fact is that during treatment with a GLP-1 receptor agonist, you very rarely see changes in insulin concentrations in the periphery, suggesting increases in insulin secretion. What you see is a lowering of blood glucose. So the effect really is the beta cell sensitivity to glucose. That is the effect. That's what GLP-1 does to the beta cell. So you simply do not have higher concentrations of insulin. So the question of insulin sensitivity also in the brain comes up as a very important feature here. But we don't know that we get an improved insulin sensitivity in the brain with a GLP-1 receptor. At least I don't. I haven't heard about it.
No, what we have in type 2 is, and that's where we have the most studies, is we call it a normalization of the beta cell sensitivity to glucose. So,
exactly. So
the type 2 diabetic beta cell, like, you know, gets back in play and know what insulin to secrete. But completely excluding it is also difficult. As I recall, there have been some old studies with inhaled insulin increasing memory function.
Nasal insulin
increasing like memory or cognitive function. So I think still also there are things we don't know. But back to what Lotte said, I think it's important that GLP-1 works glucose dependently. So it decreases glucose when glucose is high, but when glucose goes into the normal area, no effect on insulin secretion. So I think that's very, very important. So I think we, in type 2 at least, we bring it back to normal physiology, and whether Alzheimer's patients have some changes in their glucose metabolism, we would probably, by treating them with GLP-1, also normalize that, which could be a small brick in the total picture. I don't know.
That has been suggested by some of the brain studies, of course, but you know, those brain studies, they are complicated.
Oh,
you always
yeah.
end up with something that is called a lump factor,
who
can understand what a lump factor is? We also have, of course, we haven't talked about that before, the brain imaging studies. But you know, that has been also a very difficult field to follow, because it seems that different studies show have opposite findings. So I don't know.
Tina mentioned earlier, the small study in patients with Alzheimer's with liraglutide, that was actually the positive finding in that study was that with the FGG PET glucose tracer, then they actually showed a beneficial effect on, I guess, neuronal metabolism.
Uptake. Yeah, glucose metabolism in the central nervous system. Yeah.
So let's hope.
Which
for
I guess is a proxy for neuronal viability in patients with actually kind of medium stage Alzheimer's disease, right?
Again, a question which we already touched upon, do you think that in general there is a potential neuroprotective benefit of GLP-1 receptor agonists in Alzheimer's disease, or do you expect this is only a subgroup of people? I mean, we discussed already the stage of the disease, but we could also ask the question, are there probably patients which otherwise will in general show a benefit or do not show a benefit? Should we exclude patients from the very beginning, or should we focus on some qualitative aspects?
Yeah. I don't think we have any evidence to make such a choice. I don't think we have the data simply.
Yeah.
On the contrary, we would think that the improvements in metabolism and in circulatory factors and the health of the blood vessels would be general, so that everybody would benefit from these actions, and that would be also other neurodegenerative diseases. And that would fit with some of the experimental findings, I think.
And yes, we'll find out. You know, our trials are large enough to make various subgroup analyses and at least see if there are any trends to some subgroups having a better effect than others. But the trials are amyloid based, right? So it's not a tauopathy trial, right? So we won't figure out if there are any differences in a more straight tauopathies versus a more amyloid predominant Alzheimer's disease. So it's just, let's hope that we'll have more trials so we can see if the benefits go beyond.
There are actually quite a number of experimental studies in vitro and in brain sections and brain slices and neuron cultures, and they're all positive because people don't published the negative results, I guess, but there is a lot of studies in experimental studies in these cultures and in vitro systems that are positive. So I mean, unless it's completely out of the air, then we have evidence that this could be a general effect.
What we know from type 2 diabetes and obesity is that it is heterogeneous. Liraglutide was less efficacious than semaglutide. Some patients have dramatic effect, some have a smaller effect, and might be the same in Alzheimer's disease. It's, as I understand it, it's not that simple. It's also a heterogeneous disease. But we'll see in the trials.
Very interesting. Should we just ask maybe for consider the audience that, you know, is less experienced than you about the side effects and, you know, what to expect Is there anything you would like to advise in terms of, for example, GI side effects? Or you just mentioned hypoglycemia. Is there anything you would like to advise the investigators?
Well, GLP-1 is an intestinal hormone. The natural peptide has a very short half-life. The homology or the pharmacokinetic profile has been changed with semaglutide, so it has a longer half-life. You can either take it as a tablet or an injection. What we know is that the side effects are dose-dependent. So the more GLP-1 or the more semaglutide on board, the higher the risk of side effects. They are primarily in the gastrointestinal tract. They are dose-dependent, so little GLP-1, little risk of gastrointestinal side effects. And here I'm talking about nausea, diarrhea. Higher doses give some level of constipation. Overall, in short, they're mild to moderate and very often transient. It's like 10 to 15% of the patients who get side effects. When I prescribe GLP-1 in type 2 diabetes or obesity, I tell them about the potential of or the risk of having side effects, but I usually say that 85% or 90% do not get side effects. And I think that's very important, especially when we talk about body weight decrease and obesity. Some patients believe that they need side effects to have the effect. And what we have learned in diabetes and obesity is that you have very close to the similar effects, independently of whether you have side effects or not. In real life, compared to the trials, if patients have side effects, we titrate them slower and we keep them on the maximal tolerated dose. Patients who have diabetes or obesity, they can tolerate a lot if they know what the effects are. And I would imagine exactly the same in patients with Alzheimer's disease. They just need to know from the beginning that it might occur. But usually I say after a couple of months, then it is gone in the vast majority of the patients.
I think probably also important to explain about the effects on satiety and hunger so that patients would expect to actually feel less hungry and more satiated. So they shouldn't be concerned that they might, and especially maybe even a little bit more in the beginning also, that they feel less desire to eat, to be aware that that is an expected pharmacology from GLP-1.
I think it's worthwhile noticing that these effects that we are talking about, the nausea and the vomiting, they're not gastrointestinal, they're elicited from the brain. So perhaps in particular from the area postrema. So this is one of the C and S actions of GLP-1. So this must be seen in you know, when we're talking about CNS actions. So this is one of them.
Yeah, very interesting. So body weight, is that like a concern for people with Alzheimer? Body weight loss, of course.
I would say not in general, at least. I mean, obviously, there are some patients for those this might be of interest, but this is not a general topic.
Can I ask, blood pressure, does that matter?
Blood pressure is more important.
Yeah, isn't it?
Yeah,
so definitely. Again, it's interesting because here we have something that has a definite beneficial action on blood pressure. An improvement of circulation. Again, we come back to circulation, I think.
But I would imagine since overweight and obesity are becoming more and more prevalent in the background population, I mean, more than half of the population worldwide are overweight. Mm. So I would imagine that even in type 1 diabetes, patients are overweight. So unless Alzheimer's disease, probably late in the disease, they might be difficult to keep weight on. I would imagine that in average they might also benefit from losing a little bit, but that's just my, you know, general impression.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
I think there was the one question you wanted to ask Lotte.
Yeah, there is the general question. Now we are doing two very important and interesting clinical trials in Alzheimer's disease. But the question is for potential future indications for semaglutide in other neurological disorders. Might you speculate on this?
Yeah, so I can actually say a little bit more than speculation, because there are two nice clinical papers published on GLP-1 and Parkinson's disease, and there's also quite a lot of science around neuroinflammation, I think, in Parkinson's disease. So I think that's an obvious one to say that there actually could be an effect there. Via some of the same mechanisms. And then I guess we could also start to think about, okay, so if we can prove this effect on neuroinflammation in patients, are there then other diseases where neuroinflammation is important that we could then also think about GLP-1? So one thing that I heard about a couple of years ago is this intracranial hypertension, which is rising with young, especially young women, very so obese women have this intracranial hypertension. There's a group in Copenhagen and a group in London that has been studying that. And there are animal studies that show that it's actually quite beneficial with GLP-1, and I think we'll see maybe clinical studies coming also. And then also this story is a little bit funny, right? Because it actually caught NASA's attention, because apparently when astronauts have to go to deeper space, then they get intracranial hypertension. So I think NASA might actually be treating their astronauts with GLP-1 on space missions, right? I have no idea. It's just that you can actually Google that NASA has interested in GLP-1.
Let's hope they won't vomit out there.
But I think also, I'm obviously not a neurologist. I'm not even a medical doctor. But can I also ask you, what other neurological diseases, is neuroinflammation important? Are there anything that comes to your mind?
I think that especially frontotemporal dementia would be one where I would be very interested to learn more about this, because this is such an important neurodegenerative disease, and we do not have anything that we can do against this disease. We have tested anti-tau strategies several years ago without any success. So there are obviously several more neurodegenerative diseases where we are waiting for an interesting compound to be tested.
Mm-hmm. What about patients with multi-infarction dementia? I mean, talking about the cardiovascular component, wouldn't that be interesting as well?
Yes, sure. As I'm a psychiatrist, I'm not so familiar with this kind of patients. This is more something that the patients that are treated in the neurology department, but I can imagine that this would be also of interest.
And there's also experimental support for that.
And multiple sclerosis, of course. Neuroinflammation is very important there, but it is super difficult to build up the evidence actually for new indications. So I think we need the data from Alzheimer's disease and then see where we go with that.
Yeah, and this is probably the point where we can sum up that we have learned today, really, that there is huge evidence, especially from basic research, but also from clinical research, that this approach is of interest. And we are now very curious about the results of the ongoing phase 3 trials. And I would like to thank everybody here in this round for discussing today this interesting topic. And with this, I would like to conclude our discussion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.